All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Just before we start, I guess that's important to make mention. Of course, tonight is Yom HaZikaron. Probably in this, you know, because of its closeness, probably the saddest, most, you know, serious day in Israel. So I think it's important. And I see already at least one person from Israel online. It's very important. Of course, this year, even more important, the Jewish people come together. I will say they did something unusual. We, at Chat, where I teach, they always have a Yom HaZikaron, you know, assembly, and then they always have a Yom HaTzmut assembly, 2 days apart, like, you know, a day apart. They did today, this year, they decided to make the Yom HaZikaron assembly today at 12:40. And they, what they did is they live streamed the Israeli, you know, at what starts at 8 p.m., 1 p.m. here. So we actually saw, like, Herzog walking into the program and the siren, and they had everybody stand. It was actually quite moving. And they didn't play the whole thing because it's in Hebrew and whatever. They did their own program, but just to make mention, so we should merit that. We shouldn't have to have more sacrifices. And Oseh Shalom B'Merav, we should be blessed with the blessings of peace and have more to celebrate for Yom HaTzmut. Okay, just think that's important to make mention. Dr. Mark Vakasha.
Okay, very good.
In progress.
I shared that link is the talk of Rav Soloveitchik. It's only like 8 minutes or so, so it's worth saying, listening to. Some people might be very disappointed and upset by that, but okay, we're not here to cover up things he said. Again, there was always comments. This very nice issue came out, special 30th Yortzeit, 120th birthday issue of Tradition focused on the Rav. Fascinating articles, including by someone who I see is with us right now. So I recommend people listen to, go to it. It was a little disappointing to me. It shows you why I needed to publish the letters, because on page 192, you have from Rabbi Shlomo Zuckier, an article, Resurrecting Rabbi Soloveitchik's Approach to Tchiyas HaMetim. And what this is it's using lecture notes that the Rav gave as from 1948 to 49 at YU's Revel Graduate School. It wasn't called Revel Graduate School then, as far as I know. Well, maybe it was 48. That's a little early. I don't know. But, and who were took the notes? A young 21-year-old Norman Lamb. Now, oh, and Zuckier, he thanks the Dratches, Rabbi Dratch and the Lamb family for making this essay available to him. Here's the essay. I've had this essay. I was actually transcribing it. I even transcribed part of it today. It's I was going to publish it just as the whole transcription with comments on it. Zuckier, he maybe does a better thing, just summarizes it. That shows why if you have something good, you know, someone else could get it also. So it's good to publish it before someone beats you to it. Okay, a couple other things. Marty, a couple of weeks ago, mentioned that I quoted Rav Schachter as saying that the Rav, we talked about the Chazaka, and the Rav said that certain Chazakas are not applicable today, like someone won't lie directly in front of you, that sort of thing. And Rav Schachter quoted the Rav as saying, well, maybe today that Chazaka isn't applicable because of he said he misquoted it, but the upshot that Marty says, well, the Soviet ambassador, the American ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, said, well, you know, he lied directly to Adlai Stevenson's face. I actually went back and watched the video. The Russian ambassador doesn't explicitly lie. He doesn't respond. When Adlai Stevenson says his point, the ambassador just refuses to respond. So maybe the Chazaka still stands. I see that one of our listeners, our loyal listeners, also wants me to just mention, so I will. The only things we usually advertise are Torah in Motion, but I'll mention this as well, that those who are in the New York area, we have in a few weeks the mission to Washington, NORPAC. It's on Wednesday, May 10th. I know everyone's busy. I'm busy also, but if you can make it on a Wednesday to Washington, there and back, it is very important. You can email me afterwards. I can put you in touch with people. But if you live in the New York area, you must have a NORPAC chapter. The anti-Israel forces, you know, we're celebrating Yom HaTzmaut soon. The anti-Israel forces are there all the time, and there's a lot of pressure. And in the Congress today, we never had, before 10 years ago, you never had a concept of a congressperson who was anti-Israel. It would have been unimaginable, and we never thought it could happen. Now we don't just have one or two. We have a number of them, and some are on the fence. So it's important for us to be there and make our presence felt. A couple things from the previous classes. Here's the picture I mentioned. It's the only picture I know of where Ben-Gurion is wearing a kippah. All the other pictures of him in shul and things like that, he's wearing a hat. Now, it looks like, if you look at it now, it looks like the kippah is drawn on him. It's like strange. It's a little bit different than the other kippot. So, but I can't imagine that. You know, I've seen the picture many times. And now I see it on the YU Facebook, and there's something strange about it that, you know, I wrote about picture kippot that were drawn on people. So now I'm looking at it and I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe someone from the audience was at that event. Look carefully at it, and I'm starting to think that maybe he wasn't wearing yarmulke at YU because the black is a little different. So I'm not sure about this. What I can say is that all the other times I've seen pictures of him when he had to cover his head, like he had to be in a shul, Ben-Gurion insisted on wearing a hat. So is it possible that this was photoshopped on him? Maybe some of you can take a look and tell me what you think. I misquoted the title of Hartman's book, a book which I have to say, with all respect to David Hartman, I don't think after this book he can still be regarded as in the Orthodox camp, for good and for bad. I mean, the term Orthodox, I mean, he could say, fine, so I'm a Torah Jew, whatever, but what we regard as Orthodox after this book, I don't think so, and I don't think he would disagree with that. But this is the book, The God Who Hates Lies. The last book, I guess, of Hartman, because he passed away. I think he passed away. Oops, hold on a second. I think he passed away in 2013. So this would be, I'll just confirm this. That would be posthumous. Yes, 2013. I want to apologize to Aliza Bazak because I mentioned that her dissertation about this Tava Meitav Tandu, in which she showed that people did not understand it, the earlier poskim like the Rav did, I refer to that as a master's dissertation. It actually is a doctoral dissertation. So sorry, Dr. Bazak. On this issue of Tava Meitav Tandu, I went back again to Rabbi Rachman. I also didn't. I wasn't exact in how I summarized him. He doesn't contradict himself. He quotes Rav Moshe's opinion about that you can annul marriages if you find, let's say, the guy was insane and this insanity existed before he was married. But sadism, you can't. And then he says, why not? And he explains it, according to Rav Moshe, that neurotic behavior can't be foretold. Okay. But then Rachman himself makes the case that if you have a case where you have latent neuroses, which make it impossible for the spouses to relate to each other, that is, it comes out later, he wonders if that ought to be a basis for decreeing that the marriage is annulled. And at the end, he says that he puts this for the poskim. But there's not a contradiction. What I said last class, where he says that we can never avoid a marriage because of sadism, like refusing to give a get, that was explaining the standard halachic approach. And then he offers his own opinion that, but as a suggestion, not as a psak, as he later would do. The I also, I have to thank Mark Smilowitz, who has a nice article in the latest tradition, for sending me a long letter email explaining how he understands the Rav's position on Tavel Meitav Tehandu, and also Hillel, also a letter who says that for the Rav, loneliness is ontological. It's the Rav distinguishes between aloneness, a practical surface experience, and loneliness, which is an existential in-depth experience, which is ontological. And so as Hillel explains it, that the Rav repeatedly stresses that redemption from loneliness is the purpose of marriage. And Hillel elaborates on this, and that's why he says this chazaka is different. Now, I mentioned that you can acknowledge, you can reject the Rav's position on this chazaka and still agree with him that you can't void marriages. I'll go even one step further. You can acknowledge that this chazaka is an invention of the rabbis, not something ontological, not something found in the Torah. And you could also agree that it doesn't change. You can even say that halacha is an invention of the rabbis, and if this halacha, and if they were alive today, they would have decided it differently, but nevertheless, it remains the same. I say this, I don't know if you're not convinced by the Rav, I don't think you're convinced by this either, but Rabbi Bloch, the Telzer, Mashkiach in Rosh Shiva of in Shirei Das, Volume 1, Chapter 7, he develops a very interesting idea. He acknowledges without a problem that the rabbis in the Gemara, the way they decide the halacha, if they were around today, they could decide it. They could have decided completely differently. He says, about halacha, Ilu ha'isa nidonis b'dorash ha'achareim, ha'isa nikbas ba'ofen acher. I don't know if the Rav would agree with that, but that's what he says. And so then he wants to, his whole discussion is here about, since the rabbis in deciding the halacha, their decisions come from the shoresh nishmasam. It comes from their own soul, as it were. And then we decide, some rabbis say this, some rabbis say that. How can you establish a halacha based on the rov and say it's, it remains? When this was, times could change. And he says that this applies, nevertheless, not only if we assume that the rabbis decided a certain way in their day and they wouldn't have decided differently later, he says, even if the rabbis themselves knew that if they lived in a future time, they would have decided it differently. Yeah, and then he says, well, how is that possible? How can you have a halacha that the chazal themselves would know that if they were living a different generation, they'd give a different decision? How could it remain a halacha l'doros then? Whatever happened to deciding halacha based upon the era you're in? And he says that, very interesting, that when the Torah says Acharei Rabim Mahatos, that is, we go by the majority, that's, he says that the majority, that when the halacha is decided, that is Koveya Teva Habriya. That is, that he develops his whole idea that once the halacha is established, then the world mamish changes, so that had the halacha not been established, then in a future generation they would give a different halacha. But once the kaviyas halacha poalos espatsios teva hadvarim kaviya haras adin. That is for Rabbi Bloch. If once Chazal, looking in their era, determined tavo meitav tandu, then this creates the world matzias tevas teva hadvarim. Is changed. The actual teva is changed. The halacha notzeres al yedei hachacham. Lifol me'ata es pulasa, kafishu chav nikba. So Rabbi Bloch, very different than the Rav, but his approach is, he's not speaking about tav meitav tandu, he's speaking about all halachas. He says, as he says, kafiyas halacha api divrei chacham yubali asufos, that is, when the poskim establish halacha, Me'achar after shekavos halacha api rov das nikba hadin la'ad olam. He says halacha kviyas halacha it's not just Beirur HaDvarim. It's not just figuring out what the halacha is. Rather, Yotzeres he. He creates a new situation. It creates it creates a new reality. That's what he develops. And fascinating. Okay, the final point I want to mention is Rabbi Jaffe has an interesting article in the tradition about the Rav's emendations to the Siddur. Many, many emendations. You can see a lot of them in this book. Davening with the Rav, my rabbi and my rebbe, from Rabbi Gopin, who's from Toronto or Montreal. I don't know where. He's from Boston, but I knew he was a rabbi there.
He lived in Boston, but he worked in Toronto for a number of years. He was the executive director of Mizrahi before he made Aliyah. But he davened that Maimonides. He was very close with the Rav.
Yeah, the whole family is very close to the Rav. I'm not sure how Rabbi Mark Gopin is related to him, if he's a nephew or what's the story. But if you look in the back, it's amazing that the Rav, who's very conservative with a small c, and that he was willing to alter so many texts of prayers, granted, usually based on other important other gersos, the Vilna Gaon, but often just upon his own understanding. I don't think these are all traditions from his grandfather, or he finds a Rishon. You can look in the Machzor of Arne Lustiger, and he has some of them. I don't know of anyone who follows this. In the Maimonides Minyan, they do follow some of them. They don't follow all of them, that's for sure. And they made some changes. I know that in the Rav's lifetime, they didn't say Shehem Ishtachavim in Aleinu. I don't know why they changed it. But they do, and Rabbi Jaffe deals with some of these. They do use a number of them. The most famous, I think, or at least I don't know if it's the most famous, but everyone, when you go there, you'll see it, is that they, in Hallel, and then in Kaddish. What's the Kaddish we have? Let me show you something. And I mentioned this, and this will be the last thing we see, is because I think it's a, I have it here. I'm going to pull up, let me pull it up for you, the text of Kaddish, just a second. I remember when I lived in Boston for 3 years, and it wasn't that far, but I never went to the Maimonides Shul for davening. The first time I went is when they brought me in once, for Shabbos, for one of the scholar in residence weekends. So that's when I'm going to show it to you now here. That's when I saw this. And I just want to mention it because I had a conversation with one of our listeners about this. So here's our Kaddish that we say. We all know it. Yeshu Ram Varach, Lom Yomaya, Yisparach, Vishtabach, Vispar, Vishraman, Vislasay, Vizdar, Vislav, Vislav, Shmir, Shobrichu. So the types of praise, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now the Rav, and if you go to the Maimonides Minyan, at least last time I was there, they just say, and if you look in Gopin's book, page 42, he tells you why they do this. That this is based on Masa Harav, that if the traditions of the Vilna Gaon, how he davened, that he left out. And what's the reason? The reason he gives here is not actually mentioned in Masa Rav, but it's given by the commentaries that you're supposed to have only seven hilulim, opposite the seven rakiim. So you're supposed to only have seven ways of praise of God. Now here's what I'm going to say now. I don't know if this is going out on a limb. I don't know if you're going to think I'm crazy for saying this. I don't know if there's any other shul in the world, maybe in Jerusalem, that follows the gra in this and doesn't say the Kaddish. But I actually think, I'm not going to say it's a mistake on the Rav. I'm going to say, though, the Rav didn't have all the information. And I like to think that he wouldn't have made this alteration. Now, why do I say this? If he had it, I'm going to tell you now. Because, yes, the Vilna Gaon is very important for the Briskers. And the fact that the gra said it would be reason enough for the Rav to say, let's follow this. because the Gra, who's greater than the Gra? But there's one person who is more important than the Gra and has more influence on the Briskers, and that's the Rambam. The problem is, if you look at the Mishnah Torah the Rav used, the standard printed Mishnah Torah that we all grew up with, if you go to the version of the Tefillah at the back of Sefer Ava, when it gets to Kaddish, it starts with the beginning of Kaddish and then it just says V'chulei. So you see it, you have no knowledge of really what the Rambam's Girsa is. And it could be the Rav imagined that the Rambam also held like the Gra. But we actually have the Rambam's Girsa. We have it in the Frankel Rambam. We have it in the Kafach edition of the Rambam. You can check it out. And the Rambam's Girsa, he does include eight. It's a little different than ours because it's a little backwards from what we have. It's Yisparach Yishtabach, Yispar, Yisramam, Yisaleh, Yisadar, Yisalel. So not everything's in our exact order, but he has eight. Let me count it there. Yisparach, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So I wonder if the Rav, if he knew the actual text of the Rambam, if he would have agreed to delete this, because the Gra could say it, but if the Rambam doesn't hold to this, I really wonder. Now, the Rav, for the story is that when they started showing him the Frankel Rambam, because Zmanim was the first one that came out, it started appearing already in the Rav's lifetime, that he didn't want the Frankel Rambam. He says, I want the Rambam I grew up with, the Rambam I know. Remember, the Rav could tell you on any page where the Rambam's word is. It's like Gemara. We can't change the Gemara because real Talmid Chachamim know that on Zvachim, you know, Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, for the fourth line, you know, they already see the word. They see the Tosfos at the bottom of the page. You can't mess with the Tzura Sadaf. So Frankel does a good job in trying to, well, I mean, it's not the same Tzura Sadaf as the classical one, but, I mean, it has the commentaries and everything. So, but the Rav didn't want the Frankel Rambam, but what can I say? You need the Frankel Rambam because, it's the Rambam that gives us the correct versions. The only problem with the Frankel Rambam is that they don't have any notes from Rav Kook. That, I think, is the problem in the back. But in the text itself, it's great. Okay. I want to pick up now with, I'll get to the comments and questions when we're done, with the final two letters. We're not going to finish them, but at least we'll get to them, both of them. And I gave an introduction last class all about the Rav and, let me turn this off here, taking the chief rabbinate. So a nice introduction. Now, before I read the Rav's letter, let me just tell you what we find in the Helfgott book, other letters. So, for instance, on page 174, he has a letter to his good friend, Chaim Moshe Shapiro, big Mizrahi figure involved in government, a very dovish figure, incidentally. And he says to him that, explaining why he's not taking the chief rabbinate, he says, I lack the skills. What does he mean, I lack the skills? He says, I'm a teacher. I'm a Muhammad. That's the Hebrew expression he uses. He says, I'm focused on teaching Torah. I'm not adept at office management and filling administrative posts. I flee from ceremony. The job of the chief rabbi, it's full of administration. It's full of ceremonies. He says that originally I thought that we could find a way where I would be able to focus on Torah study and not have to be brought down to all those practical things. But then he says that he sees that this hope would not come to be, that therefore I cannot take this position. He elaborates as well, even more detail, in an interview on page 179. This is an interview that appeared in the Morgan Journal, the Yiddish paper, where the Rav really explains in detail why he didn't take the position of chief rabbinate. It's from 1916. He begins by saying that there's a difference between a rabbi and a rebbe. And that a rav, I guess you could say, and a rebbe. And he says that a rabbi, a rav, is one who basically is above the people. He's separate from the people. He has authority over them. And a rebbe is one who's together with the people, who's teaching them Torah, he exists among the masses. You know, there's a feeling of mutual dependence. The Rebbe needs the people, just like I need you guys, because I can't do my class without you. The Rebbe can't give a shiur unless he has students. And there's a back and forth, a give and take. You imagine, someone said to me a few weeks ago, they emailed me that that so much of the class is just based on the comments that were given and ad hoc. I don't even know what's coming in. And if we ever tried to do it without people, just like as a podcast, the class wouldn't work. Just like our trips to Europe, those who've been with us on the bus, without the give and take, it just wouldn't work. And the Rav says, is saying the same thing. You can't, you know, the Rav can just, it's funny, he's called the Rav. He thought of himself as a Rebbe, but he got the title, the Rav. Rav Moshe Feinstein was given the title of the Rosh Yeshiva when he was a posek, and the Rav was given the title of the Rav when the Rav was really the Rosh Yeshiva. But the Rav is saying here that he's really not a Rav. He's a Rebbe, because, and a Rebbe needs Talmidim, and a Rebbe is part of the people, not separated from the people. He says that's the way, and then he tells the famous story about his grandfather, how his grandfather would get on his knees and play horse and let the kids climb on top of him. He says that the rabbinate for him is learning and teaching Torah. I hate formalities. I hate being separated from the common person. That is, the people were obviously separated from him because they knew who he was. But he's saying that I don't want that separation. I want to be together with them. He says, I'm most comfortable surrounded by young students when we're sitting around looking at a difficult Rambam or a Rashba. He says that he doesn't like the fact, I'll read you the exact words. He says about my ancestors, the less official he was, the greater his influence. He's speaking about Reb Chaim. He says about himself that I don't like it if the students or in shul, if they wait for me, they till I finish Shmoneh Esrei. He says I don't want them to wait for me to finish Shmoneh Esrei. I don't know if they ever had to wait for Reb Chaim. They say Reb Chaim davened very quickly. Maybe he davened so quickly because Reb Chaim knew they'd wait for him. So they'd say that, and he didn't want him to wait for him. He says, I'm a Rebbe to my congregants by delivering shirim to them. He says, I consider my sermon to be a shir, and therefore deliver it while seated. Amazing. In fact, now that I think of it, Professor Tursky, when he would give talks, lectures, often he would sit down. I always thought that that was, but he did, I remember at Maimonides sitting down. Maybe he was following the Rav in that way. He says that I'm not a Rav, I'm a Rebbe. And he goes on and he elaborates this. He says about his forefathers, they didn't wear typical rabbinic garb. That's true. Take a look at Reb Chaim, Reb Moshe, they didn't wear typical rabbinic garb. He says they never allowed the congregation to wait for them to finish one essay. They never signed a document with the title rabbi. And the Rav never signed a document with the title rabbi. We have documents that have it, but that's because they were copied and people put it in. And then he says, if, you know, so if I become chief rabbi, then all of a sudden I now would be formalized. I'd be a rabbi. I would lose some of my freedom of thought. He even says the title chief rabbi frightens me. It sounds foreign to us, to Lithuanian ears. I don't know such titles, he says. It's true, with the title chief rabbi. What type of title is that? Now, it's not just an official title. We have the title going back already. There were chief rabbis in countries, even in Spain. In Spain, you had a chief rabbi. Well, that was like a political position. But you had positions where you had Gedolei Yisrael. But in Lithuania, you didn't have it. That's what he's saying. You didn't have chief rabbi official. It's not 100% correct, because we did have cases where the community did appoint a rav, and everyone else was under him. So that's functionally, that's a chief rabbi. But he says that that definitely was not the case in the last couple hundred years generally. He goes on to say that the chief rabbinate and the religious ministry are connected. The religious ministry is all political. How can I become a rabbi if the religious ministry is going to want to control me? He says that the Knesset gets involved in decisions of the chief rabbinate. He refers to this as shatness. It's shatness is forbidden mixtures. You can't have the Knesset, a secular institution, debating decisions of the rabbis. So that's another reason he says, I can't be involved with this. Third, he says, my job is to be a teacher. He says the rabbis in Israel don't have connections to Jewish educational institutions. He becomes chief rabbi. His whole job is as a political job and maybe deciding halacha questions. But where's the involvement with education? He says you might have to give a drasha when you come to a new building that's, you know, you dedicate it. But he says a rabbinate that is involved entirely only to sign questions of Jewish law and in administrative duties, that's the chief rabbinate, is far from my ideal of the rabbinate. But how can you be a chief rabbi and be giving shiurim? You don't have time. That's not what they're asking you for. You're hired as a chief rabbi, and your job is to be the chief rabbi. If you want to be a Rosh Hashiva, your man is a Rosh Hashiva. And that's the point. He would rather be a Rosh Hashiva. And he says that even though he knew this, he still wanted to see if he could make it work. He says the chief rabbinate is a government agency, and it cannot act independently. So therefore, I'm not going to take a position, he says, where I'm going to be controlled. And if I'm not controlled, then there's going to have all these debates in Knesset, and it's going to be controversy. So these are at least the ostensible reasons he gives. And I think it makes a lot of sense that I know we heard other reasons offered, but the idea that he would not be able to be independent in his halachic decision making, in his charting a course. The fact that his uncle, Rav Elwell Soloveitchik, who was alive at the beginning of the discussions, because he dies, I'll give you the exact date of Rav Elwell Soloveitchik. He was not alive at this time, but he was alive at the beginning of the discussions. I'll give you the exact month and year. Let me pull it up here. October 11th, 1959. So the discussions already began earlier. He was not alive in 1960, but this is the Rav's family. The Rav's uncle put a cherem on the chief rabbinate and stepping into the Heichal Shlomo. So that's got to also be weighing on his mind, that it will cause a break between him and his family. But he does say that the major reasons are what I said, that he can't be teaching Torah. I mean, he's a young man here, 1960. What is he, 57? Basically, that would be the end of his teaching Torah, he's thinking. He'd just be involved in, political things, traveling around the world, giving speeches, but doing what he loves most, giving shiurim. That's his bread and butter, not writing off decisions. That he wouldn't be able to do. The fact that politicians would have their hands in him. So these are the reasons he gives. Okay, so now let's turn to the letter I published. A letter which we knew about, although we didn't have the complete letter, and what was published in Hadoar, I don't know who changed it, but there were certain small changes made to it. And it's a letter addressed to Rav Reuven Katz. Rav Reuven Katz, Rav Petah Tikva, the Degel Reuven, someone who, if he was younger, himself could have been considered for the chief rabbinate. We did classes in Torah in Motion on Rav Reuven Katz. You can go to the Torah in Motion website. If you ever want to find the old classes, just go there, and on the search mechanism, just plug in the name of the rabbi, or plug in my name. But plug in my name, you get too many. You might be hard to find it. But plug in Rav Reuven Katz, very interesting figure. Now, Rav Reuven Katz had sons who came to America. So those of you from Passaic probably don't remember him, but Rabbi Leon Katz, or Label Katz, was a rabbi in Passaic. And then Yechiel Michal Katz was one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU. And then he had a son, Abraham Katz. So he spotted Katz, K-A-T-S-H. I think that's how he spotted her, S-C-H, who was professor at NYU in Islamic studies, and also at Dropsy, I believe. I think he was president of Dropsy. So these, why do I mention that? Because of the letter of Rav Reuven Katz was passed on. Well, actually, not the letter. He says, when your sons, he's writing to, it wasn't a letter, he wrote a letter, but then more than that, the sons passed on that their father, namely Rav Reuven, is going to stand on Rav Soloveitchik's side and help push this through. So he writes to Rav Reuven Katz that, myself, me, Hatsa'ir Bebeis HaLevi, the young one of the house of Levi, that when I heard that you, the great Gaon, Rav Reuven Katz, I heard this from your sons, that you're going to stand on my side, I decided that I'd listen to you and I'd accept the position of chief rabbinate. So why didn't he? He repeats what we've already seen. He says, I thought I'd be able to separate the technical, the political from the spiritual. I want to spread Torah. I want to devote my time, he says, Akdish, to devote myself to Iyun, Limud, Ulmachshava. The same way you, River Van Katz, were able to do. But the difference is being rabbi of Petah Tikva is not the same as being rabbi of the entire state, where literally every day you have to travel somewhere, go speak somewhere. And he continues and says, you know, the political parties, the way they want to take control of the rabbinate, people who have no connection to religion. They're supposed to make decisions that affects the rabbinate. So therefore he has to say, despite my good intentions, I have to acknowledge that I'm not worthy, he says. He says, I'm a Muhammad. All I have in my world is teaching Torah. And he says, I'm not going to leave this teaching Torah, even if you give me a malchut shlema, give me an entire kingdom. I'm not giving up teaching Torah. And then he says, I can't thank you enough. I'll always remember your friendship, how you stood by me. But if I can't teach Torah, then what am I going to do? And being chief rabbi, that would be the end of me teaching Torah, as well as all the political problems. So here we have the Rav basically saying the same thing on a couple different letters in an interview. So you can throw in the other points I mentioned that his family in Israel was so opposed to it. We can throw in that he was convinced, as we heard from Nikki last week, that so many Americans were telling him that it's a mistake. They're going to eat you up over there, and politics, which we see reflected. The fact that his wife, we heard her suggested last week, that was important, that she didn't want to be put into that role of a Rebbetzin in Israel. And for all these reasons, although in 1935 he was very interested, by 1960, although they were going to offer it to him basically on a silver platter, he turns it down. And you can play this game of counter history, how the state of Israel would have developed, would have developed differently, how American Orthodoxy would have changed had he gone there. Remember, if the Rav would have left in 1960, you're talking a good 20 years. Definitely 17, 18 years of the Rav really being active and involved and having an influence and ordaining rabbis, musmachim in New York. Had he not been there, you wouldn't have had a figure like that. Obviously, Rav Lichtenstein would have also gone. You have to think of who the other Rosh Yeshiva were. It would have, think of a place like Skokie, where you have big Talmidei Chachamim, but you don't have anyone, you don't have a master of Western humanism, of philosophy like the Rav. And in Israel, you know, they're not interested in that. So it would have been a whole different intellectual environment. Granted, maybe Israel would become interested if he was there, but it would have hurt the American Orthodox community a great deal. That's a whole generation of rabbis he ordained with a certain approach. And remember, if he would become chief rabbi, he wouldn't have been able to be the Mizrahi spokesman anymore. And positions he took and other things we wouldn't have had. So on the other hand, it might have had an important impact on the state of Israel. We have no idea what would have happened, and therefore you can only speculate. Otkan, letter 20. Now letter 21, which is the last of the letters, although I'm going to still show you next class the letter that they didn't publish. And we'll talk about whether it should have been published and what you think about this letter. So that'll be for next class. Letter 21 is a letter to this individual. Hold on, let me pull him up on the screen here. Hold on a second. Someone who I knew, and I bet many other people knew here, Professor Marvin Fox. Oh, hold on. Here's a picture of Marvin Fox as a young man. I never remember him like that. He was a Musmach of Chicago. Then he was a chaplain in the Army, and he got a PhD, and he taught at Ohio State, and then came to Brandeis, where he was at Brandeis for many years. This picture is from an article by the indefatigable Zev Elif, who's coming out with a new book. Not the sort of book that I'm interested in. It has to do with a Jewish, I think it's a college football player who's Jewish. And it's all, you know, religion in America, that sort of thing, but not the, the things I'm interested in. But he has an article here about, it's called The Tradition of the Lamb and the Fox, as in Norman Lamb and Marvin Fox. Marvin Fox was a bit of a joker also. The first day of class at Brandeis, he'd come and he'd write his name on his board. He'd write F-X. And only the people who went to yeshivas laughed. They knew what that was about. But, you know, the non-Orthodox or the non-Jews, well, what's with the dash there? The, but it was sort of like an inside joke. So they were the founders, really, of Tradition magazine. And you can read about Tradition Journal, which is now back. And thanks to its new editor, is really going strong, doing great stuff. So they launched basically together Lamb, and it was Lamb, with great assistance from Marvin Fox. They launched this, he calls it the brainchild of both of them. So they have to give them both credit, responsible for Tradition magazine, where the Rav published some of his most important writings, The Holy Man of Faith, just to give one example of it. So when he was at Ohio State, Fox was living in Columbus. I don't know if we have Columbus people with us today, but the situation of Orthodoxy was, well, I mean, it's nothing unique. In the 50s, it was on the decline. What did Marshall Sklar say? A case study of institutional decline. Orthodoxy was not the wave of the future. The conservative movement was, and synagogues were dropping the machitzas. Conservative movement was the wave of the future. So I want to show you first, before we get to the Rav's letters, what the situation was, because Fox describes it very clearly in a letter to the Rav, also in a letter to the rabbi of the Orthodox, Fox would say Orthodox in quotes, Shul in Columbus, Ohio. And then after we see the situation, we can appreciate the Rav's response. But before I even do that, I think it's important to speak about the situation of non-machitzas in America, because the younger generation doesn't have an appreciation of this. That was the trend. The family that prays together stays together, and the idea that husband and wife shouldn't sit together was not shared by many, especially the younger generation, not to mention the fact that there weren't enough pulpits. If you wanted to be a rabbi and you're coming out of any yeshiva, if you wanted to get a pulpit that had a machitza shul, there weren't many full-time pulpits. On the other hand, there were many pulpits. First of all, there were conservative pulpits. And in those days, musmachim of YU, musmachim of any yeshiva can get a job in a conservative pulpit. Later, they changed the rules, so you had to come out of the seminary. And there were also Orthodox synagogues without machitza. So some of the young people are going to say, what do you mean Orthodox synagogues without machitza? How can you have an Orthodox synagogue without machitza? Let me give you some of the figures in a few minutes. Orthodox synagogues, members of the OU, they're full of without machitza. What's then the difference in a conservative synagogue with and an Orthodox without machitza? Well, first of all, the sitter they used. The Orthodox shuls without machitzas, and where they have family seating, they would use the Birnbaum or the RCA sitter. They wouldn't use the sitter of the conservative movement. The rabbi would be a musmach. You never would have a rabbi from the, let's say, the seminary at the Orthodox synagogue. The Orthodox synagogue is a member of the OU, and the rabbi is a member of the RCA. The conservative synagogue is a member of the United Synagogue, and the rabbi is a member of the Rabbinic Assembly. So, and obviously the Orthodox rabbi was encouraging these children to go to day school and encouraging halacha. Yeah, they didn't have a machitza. And sometimes the rabbis ended up accepting this. That's just the way it is. Other times they worked to have it put in. The Rav fought against this trend. This was a trend. It was a big trend. The figures we have, I'll read you later from, well, I'll read you now, actually. Jonathan Sarna has really a classic article on the machitza. And the figure he gives is quoting a source, that in 1961, there was perhaps 250 Orthodox synagogues that had family seating. And not just in the Midwest. It was very popular in the Midwest, but all over America you had it. A 1954 estimate stated that 90% of the graduates of the Chicago Theological Institution, Hebrew Theological Institution, based on the Torah in Chicago, that was a yeshiva. 90% of their graduates took pulpits. There was a whole movement. They called it traditional. We spoke about this in earlier classes. Rabbi Regensburg, he's not the level of the Rav, but a big Talmud Chacham, he gave a heter, and not like the Rav, whose heter was just for a few years, or a year, whatever the Rav said. Rabbi Regensburg thought, you stay in the shul. As an Orthodox rabbi, keep it in our camp. And 50% of the musmachim of Yeshivas Rav Zisson Ochanan, in 1954, the estimate was, were taking mixed pew synagogues. I can say some names, but maybe I shouldn't, of rabbis who had mixed pew synagogues and then, had regular synagogues. But that was the reality. Now, the Rav permitted this, but at least as it's portrayed, he only permitted it for a year or two. And then if you can't get a change, you have to leave. I wonder if there are some cases where the Rav, when the rabbi went to them and said, look, I tried, it won't, I can't get them to Mechitzin. If the Rav didn't say, okay, we'll give it another few years or just allow them to stay. I say that because there are so many students of the Rav who remained in these type of synagogues indefinitely or for many years. That I can't believe they would have done it against the Rav's wishes. And I'll give you an example of how the Rav was not as strict as he's often portrayed in a few minutes. But I want to read you something here, though, from the Helfgott book, because the Rav was very vocal about this. In fact, I will go out on a limb, another limb, and I will say that had it not been for the Rav making this the boundary marker between orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy in a way that other, wait to hear what Rav Henkin said. Rav Henkin was not as strict as the Rav. The Rav made this the boundary marker. Imagine had the Rav not done that and not become the determining factor of what an Orthodox synagogue is. Listen, we're in a strange situation now. You can have a shul today, which calls itself Orthodox because everyone wants to be Orthodox, and yet women can have aliyahs and women can read Sukkot Zimra and things like that. Yet all these shuls, these open Orthodox shuls, Shir Hadasha type minyanim, they never would dream of taking down the mechitza. Why not? Because you're not Orthodox then, and they want to be Orthodox. The fact is that mechitza is not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch at all. And yet you can find it's not mentioned in all the halachic sources. And yet they will tell you that a woman can't get an aliyah, and they will say that you can't do Pesukah de Zimra. So it's sort of like it's going backwards, that actual things that are explicit, because they say the times are different, women can lead davening, can get aliyahs, but mechitza, because it's become such a boundary marker, that can't change. Had the Rav not insisted on this, I guarantee you, can't prove this, but I'm saying that in a liberal modern Orthodox, they'd make the same argument. The same argument that you make, that a woman could read the Torah, or get an aliyah, or daven for the omud for certain things, you can make the exact same argument on mechitza, that today we're involved with women more, we're not, you know, the same arguments can be made and would have been made. The reason they're not being made is precisely because mechitza is the boundary marker, and I think the Rav, look, we're not talking about the Haredi world, but in the modern Orthodox world, the Rav was the one, so much so the Rav, wait to hear what the Rav says, how he goes so far, and he is the one, I believe, who established it without any compromises. So if you look in the Helfgott book, just before we get to the Fox situation, which has its own interesting angles to it, Natty Helfgott in his book included a few letters. So now when we go through the Helfgott book, we'll skip these sections because we'll do it now. But he included a number of letters focusing on Mechitza, which is, of course, important because the Rav was so center in that. These letters, most of them come out of this book, The Sanctity of the Synagogue. That's the Mount Clemens, Michigan case we've spoken about. We have all the different letters here, articles all about Mechitza, the importance of it. But the first letter he has is from 1925. The Rav was put in a difficult situation because a very close friend of the Rav was Rabbi Joseph Shubo. the conservative rabbi, leader of B'nai Moshe in Brighton, Massachusetts. The Rabbi Shubels, by the way, his granddaughter is the marathoner, the from woman, I don't know her name, who runs the marathon. And granddaughter, great granddaughter, I forget which one. So that's amazing. But Rabbi Shubel was closest friends to the Rav. Rabbi Shubel helped the Rav. When the Orthodox rabbis, if you know the history, the Rav had such machlokas about Shchita, Kashrus in Boston, and it was the Orthodox rabbis who had problems with the Rav, including one of these rabbis, who later becomes, not the level of the Rav, but a really great, great Torah scholar in Boston. And the tsaras he put the Rav in, we don't need to go into it now. And Rabbi Shubel stood on the Rav's side. I believe when the Rav's wife died, Rabbi Shubel was the first one who came and sat with him. That's how close friends they were. And I think it's amazing. It shows you the ability we have other examples. We have Yechiyakov Weinberg and Samuel Atlas. Rabbi Samuel Belkin and was it Rabbi Broady? I don't know how I pronounced it, B-R-A-U-D-E, from Providence, as I recall. He's a Reform rabbi. So here we have an example of the Rav illustrating how an Orthodox rabbi and a conservative rabbi could be closest of friends while recognizing the divide, a halachic divide. So why is the Rav put in such a difficult situation? Because the synagogue built a new building, a new temple, with a new sanctuary, and they're having an event to honor Rabbi Shubel and his wife. And they turn to the Rav, Rabbi Shubel's good friend, and ask him, would he be one of the sponsors? So now the Rav's in a problem here, because on the one hand, he admires Rabbi Shubel. He even says that if you were just asking me to be associated with a dinner for my dear and distinguished friend, I would consider it a privilege to serve as one of the sponsors. But just remember these words. I would consider it a privilege to serve as one of the sponsors. How many Orthodox rabbis today would say about a conservative rabbi, a reform rabbi, that I consider him a dear and distinguished friend, and I would consider it a privilege to serve as one of the sponsors? It seems to me that today, any rabbi who would say something like this, Rachman Litzlan, would immediately be regarded as open Orthodox, left-wing Orthodox or something, you know, really on the far left. And here we have Rabban Shlomo Yisrael, the Rav. Not anyone you could call open Orthodox, left-wing Orthodox. He is saying that. I think this is an aspect of the Rav's legacy that people have forgotten. Everyone can quote the Rav. Rav this, Rav that. Quote the Rav on the Chumras and his attacks on conservative Judaism. 100%. We're going to see what he says about that. But how come they always forget what he says earlier about a conservative rabbi, that he's my dear and distinguished friend, and I will consider it a privilege to be a sponsor of a dinner in his honor? But then he says, but I can't. He says that... I can't. Why? Because what's going on now is the completion and dedication of the new temple. He calls it a temple. He says, but he does refer to him as Rabbi Shubel. He says, let me say unequivocally that I do recognize the importance of this new house of worship for the Jewish population of Brighton as a means of communal organization and unification. Notice he doesn't say prayer, but he says this temple is important as a means of communal organization and unification. And he says, and I also appreciate the fact that members of the synagogue devote a great effort and they take a lot of pride in this. I understand that. But he says that I cannot serve as a sponsor for a dinner, which is the dedication of the temple was being celebrated. If it was just Rabbi Shubel, I could serve as one of the sponsors. Now, I get it. I could see how, let's say, if you're on the more right wing, you could say, Rabbi Soloveitchik, how can you serve as a sponsor for a dinner for Rabbi Shubel as an individual? Rabbi Shubel, as a conservative rabbi, is spreading kafira. He's a rabbi of a conservative temple, and he's spreading ideologies that are not Torah true. So, but the Rav doesn't go that far. He says, we can disagree, we can still have respect. But when you deal with the synagogue, that's a destruction of Judaism, and therefore I can't. He says that this synagogue, which will have a mixed seating arrangement, is not in accordance with halacha. I have neither the right nor the desire to sanction, by me appearing as a sponsor, I'm saying that this synagogue, I'm being a sponsor for an event in honor of a new building of the synagogue, which is mixed seating. How can I be part of that? He says, my presence at the celebration or the appearance of my name as a sponsor would be tantamount to a tacit approval of mixed pews. So he said that after giving a considerable thought, I have to say that I cannot be part of this. Then he says, I'm not criticizing you. I'm not a preacher. I write this letter by humility, and I hope you understand my position. So you see here, first of all, the respect for Rabbi Shubo, which itself is worth noting, and also the fact that you can't recognize mixed seating. But he goes further. He goes more. He has another letter, pages 129 and all, and on, in which the Rav says, he repeats this on a lot of occasions, but he says, speaking to this Rabbi Lapidus in Dayton, Ohio, who was, he had been called to testify in a case about another synagogue in the Machitza. As I already mentioned, if you had given money to the synagogue and then the synagogue decided by a vote that they're going to remove the Machitza, people wanted to stop it and say, you can't do that. The money was given to be a traditional synagogue. You want a different synagogue? You can then build it. The Constitution says that we're an Orthodox synagogue. So then the American court's supposed to decide if an Orthodox or a traditional synagogue, whatever, they're supposed to decide whether you can have a mechitza or not. So there was a few cases, I think three court cases about this. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said that by putting in mixed pews, it's an attempt, quote, at Christianization of our ritual. And the Rav goes on. I do not know of any Orthodox rabbi or Talmudic scholar of high repute who would dare say that mixed seating is in consonance with our law. There's no rabbi of stature, he says, who would say that mixed seating is permissible. Rabbi Regensburg never said it's permissible. Rabbi Regensburg said, under the circumstances, as Horat Shah, we're going to send the Orthodox rabbi in there to at least keep them in the fold. Sometimes you have to have a small infraction to avoid a larger infraction. And the Rav also agreed with that. The difference is that Rabbi Regensburg didn't set any time limits. And the Rav did set time limits. And then he says, this is also important. The Rav makes a distinction. Remember, there were synagogues who had separate seating without a machitza. The Rav says that there definitely needs to be a machitza. And if a shul doesn't do that, it's violating a sacred tradition. But he says there's a difference between, he says, mixed seating, he says, is violating a Torah prohibition. What's a Torah prohibition? That there shouldn't be anything unseemly upon you. It's hard to see why that's a daraisa. As far as I know, none of the others, people who discuss this, see this as a daraisa. I don't know. I think the Rav might be speaking homiletically, because the poskim never referred to this as daraisa. The daraisa, you could, unless you say that any mixing of men and women, but the thing is, men and women were mixing, there's no difference between davening and men and women sitting together to hear a lecture. And the Rav didn't say that that's a Torah prohibition. So a lot of people have noted this and have wondered whether this is really a, and then he quotes a verse from Zechariah, which is not a Torah source at all. So at the very most, I think you can say that the Rav is extrapolating, but it's not as if there's an actual source saying that you need a machitza or you violate a Torah prohibition, like one of the 613. But he says that Christianization is mixed seating. Yes, you need a machitza, but if you don't have a machitza, we can't call the shul a Christianized sanctuary. It's forbidden. But it does not place the congregation in the class of a Reformed temple. If you have separate seating without a machitza, it's a violation, but you're not considered equivalent to a Reformed temple. Whereas mixed seating determines the very essence and sanctity of the synagogue. And then he says, because remember, this letter, and this will end with this, is from 54, when you had a couple hundred Orthodox synagogues, graduates of yeshivas, not just the YU of Torah Vadas, of Chaim Berlin, of all the yeshivas serving there, even Rav Moshe Feinstein's yeshiva. I know someone who served, who was Smicha from Rav Moshe, who served in such a synagogue. I can tell you, when he passed away, you know, the children are all I don't need to say where they are, or in a major Haredi place. He had moved to that there towards the end of his life. Of course, they didn't mention, and I understand why they didn't mention it. I understand that, but he sent his sons to yeshivas. So there was a whole genre of these sort of rabbis who sent their sons, and in his case, I think he sent them to like the Black Hat yeshivas. I don't think he ended up this. He did actually went to Staten Island. The one I know went to Staten Island yeshiva. The son, the father, in a non-machitza shul, sent his son to a Reuven Feinstein's yeshiva. I guess because he's a musmach of Ramosha, so he's under a Ruve. The Rav says it's completely irrelevant whether 50 or 5% of the membership of the RCA occupies pulpits with improper seating arrangements. He says that the violation of a religious ethical principle, you know, it's, this has nothing to do with whether a large segment of the community is engaged in doing so. If it's usher, it's usher. Even if 95% of the people are doing it, it's still usher. A transcendental tenet is binding regardless of its unpopularity. And look what he says. I think people would be very offended if he said this today. Was the commandment against murder declared null and void while the Nazi hordes were practicing genocide? You know, people get very offended if you compare anything to the Holocaust. The Rav here, he's saying, I mean, he's not comparing it. What he's simply saying is that, he's not saying that if you sit in a mixed pew, it's like you're a Nazi. What he's saying is that laws don't depend on you know, how many people are doing it. What's right is right. What's wrong is wrong. Thou shalt not murder was the commandment. The fact that in Nazi Germany, they threw that out is irrelevant. You can't sit together in synagogue with a man and woman. The fact that all the so-called, you know, Torah Jews are deciding that this doesn't apply anymore, it doesn't matter. Law remains law. Now, we'll stop here. He still has a couple more important letters, including an interview, and that's, we're going to see his famous statement about Yom Kippur. I'm sorry, Rosh Hashanah. Tkiyas HaShofar on Rosh Hashanah. And I'll tell you something, what I heard from Rabbi Parnas, hardly a paragon of the liberal orthodox, how he explained the Rav's position on this. And then we'll get to the situation in Columbus, Ohio, Professor Fox's specific situation. So let me ask question. I just see at the bottom, Mark, if I you say, if I recall correctly, the Rav's opinion is that Machitza is Derabbanan. Rav Moshe Tov is Deraisa. No, the Rav did not. The Rav says it's Deraisa. He says it explicitly. I just I saw Mark's comment at the bottom, so I'll he says it elsewhere as well. He says that not Machitza. Sorry, Machitza is not Deraisa. It's sitting together is a Deraisa. That's the thing.
Right.
I don't remember Ramosha.
But I thought the Rav's opinion about the Machitza was a Darabanan as opposed to Rav Moshe.
Yes. The Rav's opinion about Machitza is Darabanan. Seeing together, he says, is Daraisa.
Yeah, it gets out of sucker.
Yes, so, but the thing is, again, I have to look at Ramosha. I don't remember what the basis of Ramosha is, because if you say that it's, because men and women should, again, we're talking about Dafka during Tefillah. So you're going to say, well, in the base of Migdash, they were separated.
But a lot of people pointed out,
but a lot of people pointed out that the base of Migdash is, that's not the only place you have prayer. So you're extrapolating from it. Yeah, you're extrapolating from that.
But if I may, even in the Beit HaMikdash, it was Hikinu. Originally, it was mixed. It was only when the rabbi saw frivolity that they put in the Mechitza. So it's very hard to say it's the right you know, from that point of view.
Yeah. No, but you could say that the frivolity is the Doraisa, so sort of thing. But you're right. I think most, and I don't know historically whether, what the case was in Bayi Cheney. I know Professor Sperber has a piece on that. Rabbi Kalman says that he heard Rav Schechter say that Rav said this about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yes, yeah, that's what we spoke about last. Oh, you were not with us. You maybe were not there when. But this is 2 weeks ago, I think, I spoke about it. And the Rav said, Milsa Davido Aguya Lomashakri. But the thing is, and that's what Marty pointed out. But I went back to the video, and the ambassador actually, he doesn't explicitly lie. He refuses to answer the question. So I guess that's okay. It's if you're challenged and you refuse to say something. Chaim says that Rav Hartman agreed that at the point he wrote the God who hates lies, he would not be considered Orthodox. Oh, thank you for telling me that, Chaim. That was just my assumption because I know he's a very honest person. And in writing the book, you sense his honesty and you see his commitment. And he lays it on the table as to why and he's totally honest with how he then diverges from the Rav's positions. So thank you for pointing that out. Nissen says a box idea is found in the Ritva. Each generation may arbitrarily choose among the 49 reasons to say Usser, 49 to say Mutter. Yeah, he doesn't mention the that Ritva, but he quotes a number of other Gemaras. Mark says, does the Rav's emendation Shabbos Kachacha and Shabbos Mincha have a source, or is that one he corrected because it made sense to him? So let me, don't want to take too long, but let me just quickly look here and tell you what he says, if he has it here. I don't know if this book is still available, but I found it very interesting. What he has in the back here, it's just the, it's Kuntres of Yom Kippur. So he doesn't have the other stuff. And then the explanation, then he has on Shabbos, after that, he has Hanhagos HaRav, but he doesn't give reasons for the Hanhagos. So I don't know. Look, the Rav was able on his own to come up with what he thought made more sense, but I don't know about in that case. Did the Rav say Tiskabal or Tiskabel? The Rav held of Yiskadel v'Yiskadesh. So I don't know what he did over there. I don't know what if he said also Yisparech v'Yishtabach v'Yisparech. I don't know. This is based on a report that the Gra held Yiskadel. And not the Mishnah Berurah. That would not have influenced the Rav. But that's why it became popular. If you want to know why the whole yeshiva world today says Yiskadel, it's because of the Mishnah Berurah. But the Rav, the Mishnah, when they would point out things to the Rav from the Mishnah Berurah, he wouldn't be so impressed. Because remember, he's from that generation. The famous one, Rav Schechter quotes it, is about the Rav held the klisheni. We're going to talk. That's we're going to deal with next class about cooking klisheni. And it was pointed out, you know, the Mishnah Berurah says klishlishi on Shabbos, and the Rav said that my grandfather also knew how to learn, and he held klisheni. So it's unlike today where we think of the Mishnah Berurah as like, it's like we're in a different era than the Mishnah Berurah. You don't argue with the Mishnah Berurah. The Rav held of the Aruch HaShulchan, and Rav Moshe held of the Aruch HaShulchan, and Rav Henkin held of the Aruch HaShulchan. So it's a different, but I don't know. You'd have to ask people. It's not, there's plenty of people today who could tell you what the Rav said, including his children. They could tell you what the Rav did. Barry asks, where am I reading from? I heard from sources that the Rav opposed the rabbinate because the Rav's family opposed the rabbinate. Well, I was reading from the Rav's letters that he wrote. And first that Half got published, and then the letter that I published to Reuven Katz. I mentioned that the Rav's family opposed it. That could have been a reason, but that was never the publicly stated reason. It's behind the scenes, I guess you could say that. But look, that could be one of the reasons. But the Rav, we have a number of cases where he explains in print why he's not going to Israel. And he gives the same reasons I mentioned, political reasons. So you're going to say that that's all just like a, you know, that's all for like the apologetic reasons. And that's all what he's presenting, a face, a public face. But his real reason is the family. It's hard to, I think it's hard to discount what he says on more than one occasion that he could not be the teacher of Torah that he wanted, and he didn't want to be tied into the politics. David says, for a humorous and important story on the great efforts made by Rabbi Bravender when he was a young Talmud of the Rav to complete his Lonely Man of Faith publication, listen to this shir. Oh, the Rabbi Bravender has a shir. Yeah, I've heard the story. I've never heard it there, but I've heard it. It's been written that the Rav, who was it? Who gave him that job? Was Rabbi Wurzberger, I think, who was the editor then, who gave Rabbi Bravender the job. And finally, I think it's mentioned in this tradition even, that the Rav gives it to him and says, here, Bravender, here it is. You can stop bugging me now. And that was the Lonely Man of Faith. It wouldn't have been Rabbi Wurzberger. Sorry, it would have been earlier. It would have been it wouldn't have been Rabbi Wurzberger in the 60s. I don't remember who the editor was then. Yes, thank you, B.D. Deutsch, who is the elite marathoner who qualified to compete in the Olympics and did not compete after they refused her accommodation to accommodate her and hold the race on Shabbat. I have to say, maybe I'll be the only one saying this, that I thought it was crazy to ask the Olympics to change. You're going to change it because of one person who's not going to win it anyway. I think it's a great lesson for the young people. I know she's upset with it because she wanted to do it, but it's a great lesson for young people to see, Mesiras Nefesh, that you train and you can't be in the Olympics, so you don't run. And we don't need to, you know, that's part of the Rav spoke about, you know, that there's, you know, the Rav spoke about how we're part of this world, but we're separate. And we're not supposed to be completely here. We have to have these separations so we're not completely in the world. And part of that is that we have a Shabbos. And sometimes we have to sacrifice for it. And granted, that's a bigger sacrifice than I've ever had to make. But not to mention, it's unrealistic that they're going. And think of the anti-Semitism that would have caused, that the Jews can control what we do. It's to the private question of someone, the answer is absolutely yes. You can deal with me offline. I'll tell you more about that. Okay, a couple more things. Mel says, maybe the Rav said he would sponsor a dinner in honor of Rabbi Shubel to soften his refusal to be a sponsor for the dedication of the synagogue. The only problem with that, Mel, is that the Rav was not shy about expressing his admiration for Rabbi Shubel. And he was friends with him and that he was open about this. So it could be that he, in the context of that letter, he said that, but because it's one thing to have respect and be friendly with the conservative rabbi. It's another to actually, because you imagine it creates another problem with having a dinner just in honor of Rabbi Shubel. That creates the problems I raised, that you're honoring someone not as an individual, not because he gave money to Israel bonds. You're honoring someone because of his rabbinic role. And how could the Rav honor someone for their rabbinic role? But I don't know. The Rav said it. Rabbi Shubel says, traditional shuls with mixed seating were created by the CRC and the HTC. Rav Aharon lost his position as Rosh Hashiva. Yeah. Yes, we saw a few semesters ago, I showed you that unpublished letter from Rav Aharon Soloveitchik, in which Rav Aharon writes to the Synagogue. See, Rav Aharon would also give a heter, but also very limited. I showed you the letter that Rav Aharon wrote, as only Rav Aharon could. He writes to the synagogue that hired the rabbi, a non-machitza synagogue, and Rav Aharon writes to the synagogue that you should not hire this rabbi because he's not an honest person. When he became my student, he said he agreed that he would not take a shul without machitza. So Rav Aharon says, I know you don't believe in machitzas, but you certainly believe in honesty. And how could you then hire this rabbi when he broke his word? So, yes, that. But Rav Aharon was trying to change the culture at HTC. And it wasn't just a culture that grew up out of nowhere. It had Rabbi Regensburg's heder. Rabbi Shino also says, many rabbis of mixed seating shuls were presidents of the CRC. Yes. The CRC was the rabbinic council. That's Skokie. That's before that Chicago. And they then grandfathered in the rabbis who had these pulpits. As far as actually right now, there is not one shul in America, an OU shul, that is mixed seating. The last one was Beis Medrash HaGadol in Denver. And they were supposed to get rid of it, and in the end they didn't, so they're no longer OU. The one before that, I think, was Beth Tefillah in Baltimore. But until the 2000s, you still had shuls that were grandfathered in.
Beth Tefillah is a machitza now.
Yes, so they got rid of the mixed seating. So they were the second to last one, and the last one was Beis Medrash HaGadol. They decided to leave the OU, and they remain. They have minyan without machitza and minyan with machitza. I was brought in as scholar in residence last year, so I was only davened at the machitza section, and like Friday night, and they only have machitza, but Shabbos morning they still have the separate. I don't know what it is today, but as of a few years ago, or 5-6 years ago, there still were a couple rabbis in the CRC grandfathered in. But
feel also is a peculiar thing. They have a microphone that has the heksher of the Tzomet Institute, but it's kept under lock and key.
Yeah. I don't know. Beth Tefillah was there too. Some microphone's fine. I mean, it's a, I don't know why they keep it under lock and key. When I went there, they asked me, would I have a problem speaking with someone's microphone? And I said, I prefer not. But I mean, if that's the minhag and they can't, you know, they want me to. A couple more questions. Nissen says that when he last chatted with Rav Hartman, he lamented that the only place that would invite him were reform synagogues, despite him being a Talmud of Rav Huttner. Okay, but I mean, it's not just Rabbi Hartman. I told you about my wife's family, parents and grandparents and her great grandparents' synagogue, Shari Tfila Far Rockaway. Very different synagogue. Their own rabbi from years ago, Rabbi Rachman, they weren't allowed to speak there now. So times change, people change. In fact, he's a student of Rav Huttner. That's neither here nor there because his views were no longer in line with orthodoxy. So I get why.
I'm just countering what was said earlier that he self-defined as reform.
Okay, thank
that
you.
Was my counterpoint that it was what you just said, Professor.
Thank you. And let me share one final thing, final comment. Morty, you said similar story with the Israel robotics team forfeiting and getting a standing ovation from the crowd. On my Pesach program this year, and by the way, thank you all, when I announced that I didn't have a Shavuos gig, so the offers came in. I'm going to Kesher in Washington and the shuls that I couldn't go to because you came too late, Mirza Shem, another time. So we have a nice reach here. But and I come for Shabbos also. So there's a girl, a Stern graduate, she's a senior now. She's a great ping pong player. In fact, she was like number one in the country for her age group. She refused to play on Shabbos and she didn't get the title. And then the next year she got the title and it worked out for her in the end because she became famous and she's playing at all these, Pesach programs, probably Dafka because of that. But at the time, and then later that we have a Dayan who listens to the show and I had a conversation with him and I said, I don't understand. This isn't a marathon. This isn't outside. This is ping pong. And we all play ping pong inside. There's nothing wrong with ping pong on Shabbos. So, for a girl who could have, made the champion and everything and, so, we could have found a head there. Would have been so terrible. So she came to my Pesach program to give a demonstration, and she spoke about this. She was so impressive the way she spoke, and she spoke about how exactly what I said. And she went back and forth, and in the end, she said, despite the fact that technically it would be permissible, it would not make the. She didn't want to do it. She made her own. Her parents said they'd support her, whatever she did. I'm sure the rabbis would have supported her, but she herself, she didn't feel like it was the right thing. And it was so moving to hear her speak. And then she said, then that's the only reason I became famous because of that. So it all worked. And then she got the championship. It all worked out. But and then she gave a demonstration with her brother. It was a lot of fun, but it was to watch. But I understood when hearing that why she didn't do it. And because people would always ask me when I would be of that opinion, what would I tell my son? And I would always, my children, I always said, well, I want them to do what they wanted to do. This isn't like running, where I'd say you can't do it. I'd say, if you want to do this, if you really want to. But after listening to her, she made such a kiddush Hashem, and the way she explained it, I just thought it was, I have a different opinion now because that you can play for yourself, but to be in a, it's not the Shabbos. So if you do it, you're not violating Shabbos. But it's I thank her for if anyone who knows her is listening, that she really gave me insight into why it was important and why now I see it's important, which I didn't see why it was so important. Because ping pong is not on TV. It's not. Or maybe it is. I don't know. But it's not famous. It's not like tennis. It's not a big deal. It's I played at a Dalian's house. I played with his son ping pong on Shabbos in London. I think we all enjoyed that. And yes, well, final comment, Rav Huttner. I did know his daughter, Bria David, passed away. I never met her, but I benefited greatly from her because her doctoral dissertation on Amar Tzchayis, which I can send anyone. Meir Hershkovitz wrote this like 500-page book published by Masada Rav Kook on Maritz Chayes. And yet Bria Huttner's David doctoral dissertation, a young student who never wrote anything else academic, is better and gives you a better appreciation of who Maritz Chayes is than Meir Hershkovitz's massive work, which knows every source. And I just wish I could be a fly on the wall. I spoke to Yaakov Elman about this, actually, who's a Talmud of Rav Huttner. What would have been like listening to her discuss this dissertation with Rav Huttner? That's because Rav Maritz Chayes does not come out so well in that dissertation. She doesn't like him very much, too much of a maskil. And Yaakov Elman told me that she's channeling her father in that. So thank you all. And Nissan left for us the link. Again, if you can join us in NORPAC, if you're there, come over and introduce yourself. If you see me, I'll be there. I feel that you know, I'm not working on Wednesday. And if you can take off, it's not like 10 years ago. We're fighting different forces, a whole political party, the young generation, the majority is moving away from us. So we need to keep our congresspeople who still, even in that political party, are overwhelmingly pro-Israel, but they look at the polls, and we need to keep them on our side. So thank you all, and hope to see you at NORPAC in a few weeks. Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. Okay, look forward to tomorrow. Rabbi Shulman and Dr. Sokolow have their regular classes. I said, okay, wish everybody Yom HaTzimut. We spoke about Yom HaZikaron right at the beginning, but okay, we'll look forward to learning with you. We'll have a few new classes starting next week, which we will send you by email. And okay, everybody, have a great week, great Laila Tov, and be well. Thank you very much. Bye-bye, everybody. Okay, Bakasha.